Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters I find therein, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In the last episode, we covered a range of L monsters, starting with the lizard and ending with the lurker above. And in this episode, we're going to talk about lycanthropes, and maybe also the lynx, giant. But before we do that, we got to do one or two other things. Let's start by thanking some new patrons. These are the people who have gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. If, like these people I'm thanking today, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my new show, Patron Deities, which has just posted its 5th episode. So thank you to Scott Tooker and Elias Helfer. Thank you both very much. Okay, now it's time to answer some listener mail. Listener Mookie McMook, which I suspect is a pseudonym, writes, "As well represented as liches are, you can't really talk about their folkloric origins without bringing up Koschei the Deathless. Granted, he's more of a tragic figure than your average ambitious lich, but still, all the core elements are there. It's a bony old boojum who knows magic and can't die because his soul isn't in his body. So, proto-lich. Unlike the lich we know today, though, the idea is to get the phylactery needle, which I'll get to in a sec, and stab him with it, thereby reuniting his soul with his body and allowing him to die." Right. So Koschei is a character from Slavic folklore, and he is basically this old man who cannot die because he separated his soul or his death from his body, and he's keeping it in... Let me make sure I've got this right. "Inside a needle, in an egg, in a duck, inside a hare, in an iron chest, buried under an oak tree on an island." Which is very folkloric of him. Yeah, so no, he's absolutely quite lich-like, and he sort of goes around abducting princesses is his main deal. And yeah, definitely, I think that's very much a model for some versions of the lich villain, although he has slightly more human concerns than a lich typically does, and I think as Mookie correctly identifies, he's a bit of a tragic figure. You know, the reuniting of his soul with his body and his subsequent death is meant to be a satisfying resolution, not just to foiling the plot of a villain, but to kind of healing, you know, damage that hubris has done to the natural order. But thanks for writing in. That did not occur to me when I was recording the episode, and it's a good example. Okay, today we're going to talk about lycanthropes. Now, lycanthrope literally means wolfman, but here it's taken as a collective term for all humans who can turn themselves into animals. And the model for lycanthropy that is given here is the sort of disease model. That is to say, if you are bitten by a lycanthrope, you will become a lycanthrope. But you can cure your infection. Or there's a chance you can cure it magically, or you can cure it maybe by eating belladonna. So again, that kind of ties into werewolf legends. Lycanthropes transform into their animal forms at night, and they're almost certain to do so when the moon is full. Now, this is not the only folkloric model of lycanthropy. Indeed, many of the creatures that are listed in the lycanthrope section don't follow this at all. But even werewolves, who are sort of the classic lycanthrope, at least in Europe, have a variety of different origins for their shapeshifting powers. You know, in some stories, they're humans who have a certain kind of magic belt made of wolf fur or magic shirt. That if they put on, it turns them into a wolf. In other cases, they're just given the ability to turn into the wolf because they've made a deal with the devil. I don't know where the biting infection comes from. It may be a modern thing. It may have an older folklore root. I'm not really sure. But of course, our characterization of lycanthropes is basically based on the folklore that surrounds these different animals. So, for example, when we think of a werewolf, we're basically drawing on centuries of European folklore about wolves, which don't necessarily represent what wolves actually behave like. Wolves are portrayed in medieval European art and literature as particularly savage and ferocious and evil in a way that seems a little bit unfair, but that often goes together with cultures that have a decreasingly frequent contact with wolves, certainly in Western Europe and probably also in other parts. As the changing agricultural landscape of the High Middle Ages eliminates wolf habitats. Anyway, let's take a look at the different kinds of lycanthropes. So we start off with werebears. Werebears, of course, have got a root in various different cultures. Probably the one that jumps to mind for me is you get in Scandinavian legend and literature, you get people who turn into bears. King Hrolf Kraki had a bodyguard or a champion, Bothvir Bjarki, who had the ability to turn into a bear. And that's sort of associated with kind of, I don't want to use the word shamanic, but with this idea that you have a particular animal that you're associated with, and his was the bear, and he's very strongly connected to it. Then you got the were-boar. I love the were-boar. It says they're hot-tempered and irascible, typical berserker nature. And they're solitaries. They very rarely mingle with other boars, whereas were-bears are social and tend to hang out with other brown bears. And I've said before, I think when we talked about the boar, that the boar in early medieval England, in particular, is a symbol of strength, ferocity, and aggression. You know, is a symbol used by warriors. And I really like the idea of were-boars. I've used were-boars in my campaign. And I think, I don't know, there's just something about the grunting, snorting brutality of the were-boar that's intimidating in a different way from the, you know, sort of ponderous strength of the were-bear or the ferocity of the were-wolf. Next, you got the were-rat or rat-men. Now, I take these to be based on the rat guys in The Swords of Lankmar by Fritz Leiber. I know it's spelled Lieber, but it's pronounced Leiber. In that story, my understanding, and I have read it, but it was a long, long time ago, my understanding of those rats was that they were just rats. They were just, like, abnormally intelligent rats. And so here they seem to be more like, you know, put up to human size. These were-rats are based on our stereotypes about rats, right? They're cunning, they're devious, they trick people. You know, whereas we might think of the werewolf or even the were-boar as suffering under a curse or some kind of, you know, mental condition, that this is a kind of frenzy that they can't control. You know, your were-wolf might be a perfectly normal person who has no idea what they're doing when they're in their wolf form. It says here that the were-rats use their human form to lure people into ambushes, and that they work together with swarms of rats. And of course, the were-rats have their largest impact when they get picked up for Warhammer, when they become the Skaven, and then this whole culture around being ratty gets developed. But were-rats remain, you know, there are were-rats in Werewolf the Apocalypse as well, and they share a lot of the same characteristics. And again, that's because these are based on our sense of what rats are like. You know, whether that's from owning pet rats or from reading Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim or whatever, you know. So we think that rats are devious and cunning and clever and a little bit sympathetic and funny, you know. They're always slightly absurd. I mean, rats are interesting because we have a sort of societal revulsion for them, but at the same time, a lot of people like them. A lot of people keep them as pets, and we sort of view them as, you know, the scrappy underdogs of the animal world, and we admire their resourcefulness and enterprise. So it's an interesting combination. Okay, were-tigers. Now, the were-tiger, your, you know, big solitary predator, doesn't really interact with other tigers. And this comes, I think, mainly from Indian folklore, although you get them in China as well, I believe. But in India, they are said to be sorcerers. And I think it's pretty similar to the European thing where, you know, through some magical ability, like a witch could become a werewolf. So the same here. And they're, again, they just kind of symbolize how people feel about tigers, this threat that prowls around the edges of civilization, menacing livestock, maybe killing people. There are versions of the were-tiger that are sympathetic in other folklores, and so I wonder if it's to do with how those cultures typically feel about tigers overall. I don't know, actually. And then finally we come to the werewolf, and here looking very much like the kind of universal wolf man. And here we get, you know, they hunt in packs, kind of like wolves. They may be family groups, although, again, I guess that would mean that one of them had been infected and then infected the others, because, of course, in this game, lycanthropy is a transmissible disease, not something that you inherit from your parents. And they're werewolves. What's interesting about this is that there's no sense of the social role of any of these creatures really other than the were-rat, but that is primarily what at least werewolf legends are about, right? It's the duality of the transition between human and animal that is what's interesting about the werewolf. It's who the werewolf turns out to be that is the twist at the end, the punchline to the joke. So, you know, more typically, I would think you would encounter a lycanthrope in a scenario where it wasn't clear who the lycanthrope was, and in order to stop the killing, you had to find him and, you know, shoot him with the silver, I guess, arrow in this case. Now, I don't think that's an oversight. I just think it's another example of cases where the monster manual is a resource and not really... I don't want to say that it's not a guide for DMs, because it is, but it's only kind of very intermittently a guide for DMs, and there's a lot that's unspoken, and I think that there's an assumption that, like, well, you know what the narrative function of a werewolf is. You know that, like, you're going to go to a village and people are getting mauled and you have to figure out who of the people in the village is the werewolf, rather than you just run into a bunch of hairy wolfmen and have a fight with them, because that's kind of very unsatisfying. Anyway, lycanthropes are fantastic. I don't think that a whole lot needs to be said about how good they are. Like, I'm particularly fond of the were-boar just because I quite like boars as an antagonist. I think they're underused. I think they're a great image. I think they're a lot of fun. I think people are increasingly aware of how dangerous boars are. Maybe it's a Game of Thrones thing. I don't know. But, you know, they have a lot of potential, and I think they're definitely one of those monsters that we find, you know, frightening and compelling, kind of out of proportion to how dangerous they are in game terms, just because they come freighted with such a lot of interesting folkloric history, and because those animals have such important symbolic value for us, right? Like, we all know what a wolf is like, or a bear, or a rat, or a tiger, even if the tiger in our minds is Shere Khan rather than, like, an actual tiger. It better if the tiger in our minds is Shere Khan rather than an actual tiger. Finally, we come to the lynx, giant. I don't know what this one's all about. I mean, it's a lynx, it's giant, fine. There's no normal lynx, which is weird, but never mind. They're forest cats, they prefer cold regions, they climb well, etc. Right, and they can talk, and they detect traps? They're very intelligent? I don't know where this comes from. And there's this little famous cartoon on page 64 where an approximate joke is happening, right? So, like, there's a lynx kind of sitting in the snow, and then there's a bunch of adventurers arguing, and one guy says, "What do you mean we gotta talk to this lynx? The last monster we talked to ate half of the party!" Like, that's sort of a joke, I guess. I keep going back to the idea that this is a period when Dungeons & Dragons, in its newness, is sort of experimenting with its own identity, and so a lot of things that would seem obvious to us in terms of commentary on the game and its situations seem very revolutionary when they come out of the monster manual. Maybe you just had to be there. I don't know if I get this joke. But just sort of, you know, maybe that the very idea of making a wacky joke about how goofy D&D monsters are was seen as funny and revolutionary at the time, rather than, you know, the entire foundation of gamer culture, which is what it is today. Which is a shame, because the giant lynx is kind of a fun creature. I'm not sure why there's no normal lynx, but lynxes are so cool. I mean, they're strange looking, you know, they look like other cats, but they got the great big paws and the weird tufted ears, and I don't think they're particularly aggressive, so I don't think that you would actually have to fight one, but they're definitely the kind of creature that winds up being someone's, you know, familiar or companion. And even the giant version is only giant by lynx standards. Again, it's not Godzilla size, it's sort of people size. So a giant lynx is definitely something that, you know, a barbarian would pal around with, or a ranger or a druid. So I think it's a useful inclusion, only kind of made to stand out by the weird addition of this cartoon, the target of which is not clear. I will say that I do like the fact that there's all this kind of extraneous stuff in the monster manual. Like, I mentioned this when we talked about the leprechauns. You know, if you were to look at a modern day monster supplement for a role-playing game, you would see a much tighter hand on the art direction for most in most cases. And that's not what we get in the monster manual, because even though this is our big fancy schmancy hardback production, this is still a bunch of people just kind of trying to figure out what's going on. And so in that sense, this cartoon is very interesting just because it shows that process of experimentation and play at work. And that's kind of neat. Anyway, that's Lycanthropes and the Lynx, Giant. Join me next time as we move on into the M section. And take a look at some prehistoric creatures, some classical monsters, and more. So join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thanks for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory, or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.